Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and Mr. Edwards, where are you tonight?
I'm at the Target Center in downtown Minneapolis. The occasion is a WNBA contest between the Minnesota Lynx and the Washington Mystiques, if you will. Heck of a game. Washington ahead by a couple points. Good-sized crowd. Looked like a crowd of about a little over 9,000 here at the Target Center in downtown Minneapolis.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful, beautiful number down there. So we got a lot to talk about, Mr. Edwards, and a lot going on in the city, and some more shootings and violence in downtown Minneapolis. It looks like now you cannot go out to dinner with your significant other without maybe being caught in some crossfire in downtown Minneapolis.
Yeah, well, now we want to be absolutely on point. Now, when you say, you said how many shootings, Don, you're talking about in the last couple of days?
Quite a few. I mean, I can't even put a number on it.
Yeah,
I remember one that happened.
Two days ago, we had three shootings here in downtown Minneapolis right there off of Washington Avenue in the Warehouse District, and then we had another shooting in South Minneapolis. So we had four the other night. We had four shootings.
So within the last
48
hours.
We had a
okay.
couple of other homicides under mysterious circumstances, people found in their home, deceased, if you will, on the north side of Minneapolis. So, you know, there's an uneasiness in our city right now, in Shangri-La. You know what I mean?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is not good. Before we get into a whole lot of stuff here, Mr. Edwards, I would like to make sure that we send our congratulations out to the Honorable Natalie E. Hudson, named to the Minnesota Supreme Court by Governor Mark Baton just on the 18th, which was
She has served since 2001, I believe, on the Minnesota Court of Appeals, has had a distinguished record there, and is well respected. Will fill the seat vacated by the honorable and legendary Alan Page, but there will be another vacancy pretty quick when Wilhelmina Wright, who is also an African American, ascends to the federal court here in the Federal District of Minnesota. So we could have another person of color. You know, we're not sure what the politics are. You know what I'm saying?
Mr. Edwards, I would like to I was expecting the former chairman of the Council on Black Minnesotans to call in, Pat Wynn Lawrence, to give us an update on the lawsuit. We know that there's some back and forth and some tugging here and tugging there between the executive director and the state and the attorney general's office, and I was hoping maybe sometime before the end of the show here, because we're going an hour and a half tonight, that he will call in and give us an update and to see what's
going
on.
Well, that would be just great. That would be just great.
Yeah.
Now, they've been joined by the NAACP and the Urban League and the Leadership Forum? Or is that
oh, no, not at all. I think that's just a rumor. Yeah,
okay.
And I was trying to clear that up when Mr. Lawrence called in, and we figured out what was happening, and hopefully, you know, he does get with us. He said he'd call in sometime during the show, and then we'd stop in mid-stroke and find out what's happening and what's going on.
Yeah, so that we can make our listening audience familiar with the tenets of the lawsuit. It's a rather interesting lawsuit. It's very rare for a, you know, entity connected with state government or with any, you know, governmental situation to, you know, suit that entity. In this case, the Council on Black Minnesotans is a part of the state structure, and that was quite a bold action. But I had thought that the NAACP and Urban League and those organizations and the Leadership Forum, which is probably one of the most powerful forums here in the state of Minnesota on behalf of African Americans. I thought they would have joined in the lawsuit, but maybe Mr. Lawrence can help us understand if the negotiations broke down or if there was any offer. You know what I'm saying, Don? Yeah, because it's all about information, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And speaking of information, you mentioned the African American Leadership Forum, and Mr. Edwards, that is what that group is a part of. Many groups here in the Twin Cities or in the state of Minnesota called Collective Impact groups or Collective Impact organizations. And for our listeners that don't, know, this is a teachable moment. A Collective Impact organization or group is a group of intellectuals from different sectors that maintain a common agenda for solving a specific social problem using a structured form of collaboration. A collective impact group, Mr. Edwards, should bring people together in a structured way, I mean everybody at the table, to achieve a social social change or to correct a problem. You find these groups in animal welfare, homelessness, youth and community development, health, and in Minnesota, more importantly, in education. So, you know, we have Northside Achievement Zone, Generation Next, the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, and the African American Leadership Forum. But the trouble
let me ask you a question, what you're reading from. Now, is that their mission statement or manifesto?
I had published a story yesterday, and I'm actually looking right at the story because I did a little research to try to find out who these organizations were in the Twin Cities and exactly how they fit together. And Mr. Edwards, I have to say that I was really shocked to find representatives on Generation Next board from Chandra Smith-Baker, Lynn Nordgren from the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, the president of Augsburg College, Miss Louise Marie Ferris, the president of Community Philanthropic Philanthropy, of the Minneapolis Foundation, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce interim president Bill Blazer, and these are all movers and shakers. Betsy Hodges, City of Minneapolis mayor, of course. Eric Mockmuth, principal of Harvest Press Seed Academy, Commissioner Peter McLaughlin, and Sandra Samuels, CEO and president of the Achievement Zone. And those are just a few of about the 20 or so names that I've read off because, Mr. Edwards, I've always wondered who controls where the money goes from the foundation and who gets the money in the Twin Cities and why at this particular time do we have such a wide gap? And I'm going to get to that here. You know, I was just looking at third grade because, as we talked about in the past, Mr. Edwards, at third grade, especially Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools and across the country, that's when the powers that be, the white male patriarchal system, status quo group, decides to build prison and how many jails they would need, citywide and statewide. And it's based off these scores. So I'm looking at the third grade in St. Paul Public Schools. These are not my numbers, Mr. Edwards. These are numbers from the Minnesota Department of Education for St. Paul Public Schools. These are black children. The proficiency in grade 3. In 2013, it was 37%. 2014, it was 41%. And now in 2015, it's dipped to 36%. Now, this number, it represents 2,900 students, of which 1,881 are not proficient, which is 63%. We know that 70% is failing, but if you dig a little bit deeper, Mr. Edwards, and we had talked about this in our production meeting a while back, so I said, well, you know what? We don't talk about the Native Americans as much, and I think that their numbers should be put out there too. But I was shocked to find just in the St. Paul public schools in the third grade students, Native American, in 2013, their proficiency was 30%, in 2014, 38%, and in 2015, 28%. Now, this represents 73 students with 52 not proficient, which is 71.2% of that particular Native American population in third graders in the St. Paul public schools. And those are shocking numbers. Those are devastating numbers. So how do you fix it? What are they going to do? Well, now we've talked about the collective impact organizations and collective impact groups. that sit in these big rooms and have become social organizations, and that's not the way that these things are going to be solved. And I'm working with a couple of people here. There's one gentleman named Tom Wolfgram who just writes eloquently about this, first things first, and the theory of constraints and removing those constraints. But one of the things we both agree on is that we have to go back and have a contract with mom, parents, and caregivers, more specifically a contract with mom, to have that child ready to read by kindergarten. And that's something that they're pretty much overlooking at this point. So needless to say, I'm shocked by these numbers. I shouldn't say I'm shocked or surprised. You know, this is just, you know, these agencies funding each other, patting each other on the back, because if they keep our third graders, let's just not even talk about kindergarten, first and second, if they keep our third graders at this level of proficiency, what do we call them? A functional illiterate?
Functional illiterate. That was a term that we created in the 1960s in challenging what was happening at that time. And a startling and very troubling percentage of African-American children were functionally illiterate. And I'm quite sure there are experts out there who are well-funded that will totally explain to the listening audience what that means. I would assume that the organizations that you previously mentioned, these impact groups, if you will, are certainly working on this. I assume that we should have had a manifesto delivered to the overall community and to the funding community, because the funding community certainly takes care of them. If I'm not mistaken, Ms. Samuels and her organization is still sitting on about $23 million for the small education zone that they work in North Minneapolis. So, do we have any indication from anybody that they will be making a annual report with recommendations, solutions, and et cetera, or will they just continue to receive funding, live good, talk big, and do nothing?
Yeah, exactly, Mr. Ellis. And I want to make it clear to our listening audience that, you know, these conversations are important, but usually intellectuals that sit on these different committees, these different collective impact groups and organizations, you know, they don't have the process. You know, like you and I, Mr. Edwards, we can have vision, but we're worker bees. And a lot of our listeners are worker bees. They get the job done. They know how to start from A and get to Z. And so what happens is, you know, all these people, some of them I mentioned on that group that sit on the board of Generation or the Leadership Council for the Generation Next, you know, they can look right down the row of chairs and see a buddy that they can depend on for whatever they need. So it's not necessarily solving the issue. So I think we have a former Council on Black Minnesotan Chair Patwin Lawrence with us. Patwin, is this you?
Oh, well, why don't you bring him in, Ms. Allen? You've already talked to him prior to pre-meeting and get him engaged.
Yes. I'd like to welcome the former chair of the Council on Black Minnesotans, which is now the Council on Minnesotans of African Heritage, see her or something like that, but we'll get to it eventually. Patwin Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Can you give us an update of what's going on? Because we wanted you on last week, but we know you're busy and I caught you late, but that's okay. Can you kind of fill us in from what you know, diplomatically, politically correct, or however you have to? Mm-hmm. What's happening with the Council on Black Minnesotans right now?
Well, Don, you know, there is a bit of a struggle. So Edward went ahead and filed, you know, a lawsuit against the state, which was, you know, that was what was discussed in the Star Tribune article, you know, early last week. And, you know, some of the remaining board members, they don't agree with kind of the course of action that Edward has taken. And then also the state, now the Attorney General's office, they are challenging the lawsuit. And so there's actually, it was a board meeting supposed to be happening today, a special meeting, and I didn't attend, and I wouldn't have been able to be in the special session when the attorneys were going to be there to discuss the matter, as I'm no longer a board member. However, I just want the community to know that, you know, there are forces at work that are trying to, do away with this lawsuit. But I'm very glad that Edward went ahead and filed. That's something that needs to be done, because we just can't let legislators just, you know, run over the community and kind of have their way without even consulting with members of the community about what they want to do. And so we need to teach them a lesson and show that, you know, there are people in the community that will stand up to them and, you know, be willing to hold them accountable. Because when they're passing legislation that has serious separation of powers issues, the whole way that they went about not consulting the community but saying this is what we're going to do, this is what we've been planning for a while to do, we don't like the work that you're doing, so, you know, we're going to make these changes to you because we don't like that you're calling us out and holding us accountable on how we... And so really that's what is going on. And so I just want the community to know that what they really need to do is put pressure on our legislators, particularly our legislators of color who are behind this, Representative Lane, Representative Moran, Senators Champion and Hayden, Senator Pappas, Senator Torres Ray. And we really just need to find people in their district and run people against them. I'm considering running. Actually, Senator Champion is my state senator, and so I'm considering it as well. We just need to get real people from the community to run, to inject, at least inject real issues. We're tired of these cosmetic issues that they keep bringing up that really are trapped in a false paradigm that people are trying to find solutions to, like you were just talking about education. And there's this false paradigm that they've set up around education, and why we can't ever solve anything is because we don't really know what's going on, and so we're never able to come up with the right answers to make the change that people want to see. So that's the solution that we need to do.
Well, you know,
I have a question on this end, Don, because we need to know what are the contentions and concerns of the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. Lawrence, we need you to share that with us. What are their constitutional issues? Is there a prohibition? Do you not have standing? Because this is one of the things we had promised our listening audience at the top of the program. Can you give us an indication of what the Attorney General, Lori Swanson, is now saying is a prohibition against the Council on Black Minnesota filing a legal action?
Well, from what I have heard from board members and coming out that have, you know, come public, is that they don't agree with, what they're challenging is that was it a lawful board meeting that last Saturday, where it was my last board meeting as well as three other board members, we were rolling off. And I made the motion not because Edward wanted me to do it. It's something that I've been waiting to do for months, and that was to empower Edward to seek injunctive action in terms of the legislation and have a court to review it and also look into the audit of the state. They've been auditing the councils. It's time for the state to be audited to see if they are in compliance with our, you know, civil rights and equal opportunity laws. And so it did pass. We did have a quorum, but they're seeking to challenge that. I know at the meeting following that June meeting, the board or remaining board members refused to ratify the minutes from that board meeting because they said, well, nobody that was at that meeting is now on the board except for one person did abstain at the meeting, but we did have a quorum, and so we have people that are on the council that are working internally to undermine the work of the council, and they've been doing it since they've been on the board. And so now they see this as their chance, whereas since I'm off the board and other board members who were supportive of the action that, you know, that the executive director, Edward McDonald, is taking, that now that we're off, they think that the council is vulnerable. But they're, again, they're mistaken, because we have a highly competent and qualified executive director that we put there, and then we also have members in the community that are supportive. So,
all right, let me ask a couple questions
sure.
as it pertains to the procedure and what you're at, because it's rare what you did, and you're to be commended, but it's also rare for the legal representative of the state of Minnesota, who is by constitution the attorney general, because
mm-hmm.
normally the attorney general would be your attorney of record. Is the attorney general saying that they will not represent your interest in the court, and are they saying that you will have to obtain other counsel?
Well, so I don't know what has been said in relation to that since the legal action has been filed. But what I do know is that when we have been discussing this in prior months, where the Attorney General office, they represent their, you know, represent the council, but in this matter, if we did want to, you know, sue the state, they would not be able to do that, and they made that clear to us, and so that's why I assume Edward has, you know, an attorney that's, you know, filed on the council's behalf and on his behalf, because this personally impacts him, you know, and his employment, you know, with the council.
So,
okay.
For absolute transparency and clarification, the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota seems to be threatening not to provide you with legal representation and support, which then means that Mr. McDonald will basically have to obtain private counsel. And, of course, Edward or the council has that kind of money. I mean, you're talking in terms of two-quarters of a million to half a million dollars, right?
Well, you're correct. However, we are already prepared. We already, you know, taken that into consideration, and so I'm sure Edward has worked out something with the attorney that's representing him. So I'm not, you know, concerned, you know, about that. I just want to see what's going to be taking place, because the judge that it's gone before has, I believe, or is going to respond within 20 days. So we should know something either next week or the following week. I don't know if it's like 20 calendar days or business days. We'll know something.
Yeah, let me again ask these questions, because I'm a person for detail.
Sure.
Who is the judge that has the case?
That I do not know right offhand.
Okay, maybe Mr. McDonald can text us and kind of let us know. That will go a long ways towards determining how the rights of the lawsuit would be protected. I'm a little bit taken back, Mr. Allen and Mr. Lawrence, that the Attorney General has turned their back on you.
Well, I mean, because we had been, you know, advising them that, you know, when we go through this legislative session, if we're having issues, if we see that we're being stymied, which, you know, legislators of color and others did, you know, derail our, you know, legislative agenda that we sent there, work to undermine us, especially Representative Moran, who sits on our board, was doing that. I have the emails where Senator Pappas, she was going to carry our enabling legislation, but then Representative Moran went and talked to her, and then she sent an email to Edward saying, no, I'm no longer going to support you in your legislative
we had Representative Moran. We had Representative Moran on our program a couple months ago, and she kind of gave
us,
Mr. Allen, a different narrative.
Yes.
And, you know, what we probably
yes.
want to do, and what you and your attorneys, or certainly Mr. McDonald's attorneys, you may want to mm-hmm. go back on demand and recapture that program, because, wow, the
mm-hmm.
state representative told us something altogether different.
Yeah, and I had the emails, because I was copied on the emails when that, you know, when that took place. And so that's why when Representative Moran had her listening session where community members were upset at her, you know, I just let her know that, you know, her and Senator Pappas, who was there, and Representative Lane, that they were sitting up there lying to the community. And they are. They're liars. They'll sit up there and try to sit in a place of authority where they're the legislators, and they're doing everything right, they're doing what's there for the community, and they're saying one thing, but when I know what's going on behind the scenes and in the back room, so to speak, I know what's going on, I call them out. And that's for community members. We need to stop bowing down to these people, and we need to hold them accountable. We need to call them out. When we know they're lying and they're trying to deceive the community, they need to be called out for it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Mr. Allen, I'll let you continue to reflect with the former chairman. Do you have any additional questions?
Well,
our phone lines are open, by the way.
Yes, they are. And I would just like to encourage Mr. Lawrence to, if he is considering a run, that he should definitely, consider it, because, I'll be the first one there to do whatever I can to help you out. Because those guys are vulnerable, and they've been twisting the community for a while now. And a lot of people are tired of it, and they've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically what I have to say. Now, in closing, do you have any final words you'd like to share with us, or any just anything before we let you go? But we do appreciate your call. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, thank you all for, your support of the council and the encouragement. I want to thank members of the community for their encouragement. It is, a bit concerning going up against the state, but it's something that needs to be done, because they need to see that, there aren't, not all, the African American people are going to bow down to them and kind of, be corralled in the way that they want. But we really want to seek equity and justice for all Minnesotans, not just for the African Heritage community, which we do. We work mainly for that community, but we want all Minnesotans to benefit, and that's what our action will seek to do.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
thank you, sir. Appreciate
time.
You taking the time. Thank you.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Phone lines open, Ms. Allen. We haven't given the number. Our phone lines are open. Maybe there are some supporters of the legislative group that was identified Mr. Lawrence as apparently being obstructionists, or certainly doing some things that seem to represent obstruction. Throw that phone number up.
Sure. That phone number, the number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number, phone lines are open at 347-426-3904. I know we have a couple of people in the queue, and if you'd like to talk, just go ahead and hang up and call back, and I will just go ahead and hit and answer it right away for not in conversation.
Right.
That's pretty
all
interesting, right. Mr. Percy. And also, Mr. Eric, I'd like to bring up something concerning veterans here in the state of Minnesota.
Sure.
And I didn't get a chance to run this down to you, but when you hit the tail end of this, Mr. Edwards, you're going to be pretty shocked. But on Monday, I submitted a data request to find out how many African Americans are working within the system of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is something that a group that represents all veterans in the state of Minnesota and represents them on a local, state, and federal level. And they have tons of opportunities here locally in the Twin Cities for veterans, supposedly. Now, I've walked in the Veterans Service Building on 12th over in St. Paul off 94, and I've been through all few floors there, the three floors there, and from top to bottom, and not one time, Mr. Edwards, have I ever seen anybody that looked like me working there. And that kind of troubled
wow.
me. And after about the fourth or fifth time, I said, and I was a little concerned. And I know I talked to you about it, Mr. Edwards. And I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and put this data request in because there's something wrong here. So you have the Council on Black Minnesotans asking the Minnesota Department of Administration to audit these state agencies, including the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, MnDOT, Met Council, et cetera. And there has to be a reason behind it. And so with that in mind, I sent a data request to just find out the numbers. Well, Mr. Edwards, I applied for a job at the VA and at the Fort Snelling at the Whipple Building, over a month ago. Today, when I get home, my phone rings and says, Mr. Allen, can you come into the VA for an interview on Friday? I said, what? This is long after the job position was closed. And
right. Are you aware that the job position has been closed? Are you sure this was the recording that you were listening
no,
to?
No, no. Mr. Edwards, I used to work at the VA, and they told me the lady who called me says, yeah, meet me on the fourth floor in human resources, gave me the right number, gave me her name. I verified that she did work there. She wasn't in HR. And I actually told a state senator. The state senator, Senator Chamberlain, sent me a message because I copied him on the email because he sits on the Veterans Affairs Committees for the state of Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
Him and several other, mm-hmm. him and several other senators. And he replied, squeaky wheel. The squeaky wheel gets greased. And I said, wow, this is highly unusual. But I don't think, you know, from them distributing millions of dollars for homeless veterans and not collaborating with one African-American agency in town, that was troubling. And as you know, I went there several times with several different people, including the executive director of the Council of Black Minnesotans, Mr. Edward McDonald, to talk to them about that. And it's just like they didn't give a hoot, basically. And so hopefully in 20 days I will get this information and we can find out exactly if they're in compliance with state of Minnesota affirmative action. And I know a lot of listeners, a lot of our right-wing listeners, you know, I'm down on the right, so just follow me on this. It's not about being a victim or playing a victim's role. It's about finding out for veterans, who we're all green, basically, to find out why veterans of color are not in these buildings. How come they're not represented in equal numbers? I mean, Mr. Edwards, didn't they used to have a commissioner, an African-American commissioner of the Veterans Affairs of Minnesota?
Yes, the state of Minnesota is only, in fact, I made reference to him in a column 2 weeks ago in my column in the Spokesman Recorder, talk terms of the now departed Alan Page, 22 years on the Supreme Court bench, one of the most outstanding jurists. His name was Elmer Childress. Mr. Childress, who was a native of St. Joe's, Missouri, had been a telephone repairman, if you will, one of the first African-Americans to get a job here in Minnesota with what was then the Bell system. We used to call them the baby bells, if you will. He was appointed by then Governor Wendell Anderson. In fact, Doug Kelm, who is the father of Michelle Kelm Hagelin, who is the chairwoman of the Sports Facility Authority, where there's some heat being generated. But anyways, Tom Kelm recommended Mr. Childress, an African-American, long time, deep roots in South Minneapolis, if you will. And he was appointed and served with dignity, integrity, and effectiveness for 4 years as the commissioner of the Department of Veterans Affairs. There hasn't been one before him, hasn't been one since
wow.
and after him. But, yes, to your question, the late Elmer Childress, yes.
Wow, okay.
In
wow,
fact,
that's very interesting.
We would have
yeah.
probably known that. You'd probably have been able to talk about it if we had a Black History Museum, oops. But we don't, yeah. And so I think there is a picture. Next time you go over to that little fortress-like building right there with the cannon out front, you may want to take a look along the Hall of Memory, as they call it, and you will see, I'm pretty sure they still have his picture up there, the picture of Commissioner Elmer Childress.
Okay. I will look at
that. He also ran for Secretary of State, State of Minnesota, and was the only person on the ticket that lost. This was in 1970 or thereabouts, but just a great human being, a great person, and to your original question, yes, he was the first and only commissioner of Veterans Affairs in the history of the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so in closing on that subject, you know, I'm concerned, you know, for other veterans because I hear, you know, horror stories in some cases, and I know there's some truth to them, and there's two sides to every story, and then there's the right side, of course, and we just need to nip this in the bud because there's a lot of good guys out there, red, yellow, red, black, and white, that all serve, that deserves a shot, you know, at anything that the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs has as far as employment.
But wait a minute, Mr. Allen, I have to ask you from the left now. As a leftist and you know, a person in support of the Democratic Party of the United States, where a candidate will probably be Ms. Clinton. Now, Don, why didn't you not go to both our federal and state representatives, our two senators, and Congressman Keith Ellison, who I think is your congressman, as well as our, Representative Lane, who we had on this program a couple months ago. She's your state representative and your state senator. Why have you not gone to these people and expressed your concern, Mr. Allen?
Well, Mr. Edwards, when you go to people, from my experience, when you go to people in the Democratic Party, the people that you might have a complaint or concern about might also be Democrats. Okay? They're friends. And you know, in this state,
what I'm asking from the left, have you given them an opportunity to do the right thing? Have you visited with the state, with federal representative, Congressman Ellison? Have you visited with the offices of Senator Franken and Senator Klobuchar?
Oh, no.
Have you met with the state senator? You have?
I have not. What? I have not talked to any of them.
Okay.
I will send them an email.
Okay. Well, have you talked to your federal representatives then? Have you talked to them?
No, I have not. No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, in the past, I had dealt with Congressman Keith Ellison's office. I think his Mike was his name, the guy in that office who just was pretty much incompetent as far as I was concerned. And did not follow through, so I just chose not to. The last time I ran into Congressman Keith Ellison, I said, "Hey, Congressman Ellison," he put his head down and walked right by me. And I'm his constituent, you know, I'm in his district, 5th Congressional District. So if he treated me that way, you know, I just don't really want to have nothing to do with him, period.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, hopefully some of our religious and you know, particularly the religious community, because it's so important to treat with fairness and dignity those who serve to protect our country and protect us as best they can and have given their lives. So hopefully some of the clergy and some of the political leaders will contact you and will be prepared to step up and raise the question to the current commissioner of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and actually directly to the office of the governor, our beloved governor, you know, who was pretty upset today because there's no bailout for Mille Lacs Lake and the resort owners up there because, you know, there's no walleye in the lake, and people like to fish for walleye. I'm not a fisherman, if you will, but, I know the fishing stories. And the governor looked like he was pretty perturbed today that things were not, you know, coming back in a responsive manner to his concern about bailing out the white resort owners of our beautiful Mille Lacs Lake, a beautiful facility, a tremendous, gigantic lake, and et cetera. So, you know, I'd certainly put a call into the governor, you know.
I think I will. But, Mr. Edwards, you just touched on something that is pretty I had a couple conversations on Facebook and on emails regarding this. Now, These resort owners in Mille Lacs have a problem with some fish.
Walleye.
I'm not a fisherman either, or a sports person, as you know. But
yes.
So they have a problem with walleye. A walleye is a fish that lives underwater that wouldn't know the difference between me or Jay-Z, okay?
Yeah.
We have a whole community of Native Americans, Minnesota First People, African Americans, poor white Americans, Asians, Somali, that are unemployed within the black community. The unemployment is double digits. To me,
what I thought you were getting ready to say was that we have a whole community underwater. Oops, but go ahead.
Oh, man. You almost made me get out the oxygen tank. But we do. That's perfect analogy, metaphor. We have a whole community underwater, drowning in poverty. It's become a distraction. You can see its peripheral effects in education, in crime, in youth violence, the shootings downtown, and all these things together that are happening that people aren't paying much attention to. You know, but you let it be a fish or a dog, or let's not go to Africa and shoot a lion. You have everybody out there housing. You know, shot a lion in Africa. Oh, in Africa there are black children starving and dying every day by the hundred. And there's more protests for a wealthy dentist who actually had tour guides that made him think it was illegal to shoot a lion. It's become, you know, they defaced his building, his home, his garage. You know, I mean, it was ridiculous. But yet, when you get to people in the Dark Continent, we don't hear nothing but crickets. Nothing. So I think that's
like I said, the governor wanted to have the legislature appropriate $20 million to help out the owners up there. I got to thinking in terms of, wow, it would have been helpful if they could have appropriated maybe even one-fifth of that for the colored community, and particularly those Native Americans whose treaty rights are violated all the time, particularly with regards to hunting and fishing, if you will. The band the band of Native Americans at Mille Lacs have been pretty, you know, politically powerful, astute, effective, and tough notes, if you will. But we got to get some walleyes into that lake up there. You know, we got big mouth bass and crappies and stuff. Yeah, we got to get some walleyes. We got to get the guys who are coming in to be big fishermen and et cetera, and keep them happy. You know, let's save the walleye. Oops.
And Mr. Edwards, I hear they're making a killing off medical marijuana too. You ain't heard much of that in the news lately, have you?
Yes, yes. In your community, who is disproportionately incarcerated in the state of Minnesota for marijuana activities. I'm separating it out from crack cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine and et cetera. But, I couldn't quite understand the logic. Yes, I can. I'm telling the story. You know, the determination when the legislature said, you know, we can have medical marijuana, however that's supposed to be defined, if you will. And I'm trying to figure out how many African Americans and others of color were using marijuana for purposes of medical problems and et cetera. And, you know, nobody ever used to talk about that, you know, when they had just record numbers of African Americans going to jail for marijuana, being shot and killed in the streets and et cetera. But I don't know, you know, that's for the leaders, that's for the great minds of our communities and organizations. Maybe this is a question that Black Lives Matter can ask the next time they meet and argue with Hillary Clinton or Senator Sanders, who is running for president also. I just don't know. The current is too swift for me.
Yes. I agree 100%. Hey, Mr. Edwards, now getting back to some local stuff, I was just wondering, you know, there has not been a lot of public information about that 68-year-old woman in North Minneapolis, the artist and community activist who was found mortally wounded in her home a few weeks back. And, you know, our condolences to her family, friends, and coworkers. Her name is Susan Spiller. Have you heard anything, or do you have any updates on that we can share with the listeners?
Well, talking about the activists, and we want to let our audience know. I mean, we are just as concerned about the fact that white lives matter, just as we are concerned about Black Lives Matter in all regards. Question is a politically delicate one, Mr. Allen. About that in the production meeting, that it is a little delicate, if you will. The suspect is known. Has been known now for almost over 3 weeks. There's a problem.
I didn't see that in the Star Tribune.
Beg pardon?
I said I didn't see that in the Star Tribune anywhere. No. Okay.
The Star Tribune hasn't really written about how the case was going. You know, again, it's a political sensitive issue for the Hodges administration. You know, she was a very good friend of Council President Barb Johnson, who is someone that you would probably not want to antagonize or upset.
Oh, never.
You know, here's the situation we're faced with, Mr. Allen. I don't want to seem to be evasive or trying to skirt, but what happened was 3 weeks ago, Black leadership in the community maintained that they had the name of the suspect, that they were about to bring the suspect in. The Minneapolis Police Department was full alert to receive the suspect, if you will. Leadership also met with County Attorney Michael Freeman, gave him the name. He apparently reached out to the sheriff. The sheriff sent our SWAT teams and et cetera into the community, the neighborhood. Unfortunately, political leaders made calls to the leadership of the council and the mayor's office indicating they were going to be participating in the surrender of the suspect, if you will. That was over 2.5 weeks ago. It didn't happen. And so now we're looking at a situation where the white citizenry, particularly in the far north end of North Minneapolis, are saying that African-American black leadership are hiding and giving aid and comfort to a suspect who was involved in a very heinous, vicious murder of a woman that should have been safe in her home, if you will. So that's all I can impart. I'm not at liberty to name any names at this point. Some listen to our program. They know who they are. It's really unfortunate that they did not come through. And the suspect now, has not been seen for, the suspect hasn't been seen for over 2 weeks. So I hope that helps you out, Mr. Allen. And I indicated to you in the production meeting that I would have to go in that direction.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Same name. I mean, I wonder what they were. Whoever these community people are. It sounds like maybe they could have been waiting for a reward. You know, all these people, like the young boy over north. I'm sorry, Mr. Edwards. His name's escaped me. Where his mother was going around to different schools and talking about her son.
Oh, you're talking about the young child. You're talking about the young child who was shot. Inside of his home by a bullet that actually came through the wall and hit him as he was going up the stairs to a safe room?
Well, now that reward is $60,000. That was just posted. $60,000 posted on Mr. KG Community Active Crime Activist KG
Wilson. Let me just say about that. Yeah, I understand that because I have to say in all fairness, over $50,000 of that $60,000 was advocated and lobbied to the Minnesota legislature almost 2 years ago by the Minneapolis Police Department. In fact, there were two at that time one was a deputy chief, the other was a commander. The deputy chief was a Caucasian, the commander was an African American, very well known. In fact, I was just in his company on Saturday at the big barbecue cookout and contest that they have between the fire department, the park board police, and the Minneapolis Police Department. But 50,000 of that 60,000 was abdicated for and lobbied for by the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm not sure what the award is in the case of the white activist female brutally murdered in her home in North Minneapolis. I hope that's not what is happening here because it should have been better thought through, Mr. Allen, when calls started being made to elected officials that, leaders were getting ready to turn traitor in. You see, this is not something you can play at when you talk in terms of surrendering an individual. You got to know what you're doing. And one of the things you really got to do is make sure you got the person yourself in custody. And it's a very, very embarrassing situation. It's a very dangerous situation. You've asked the question. I said to you in our production meeting that I felt compelled that a colleague of mine has asked the question. The public has a right to know some aspects of it. I would suggest that the mayor, and city officials indicate and give an update. I know that the case is really not being worked very hard on, I can tell you that. Yeah, even though the name of the suspect is known. That's what I'll have to say. Yeah. The name is known, but I don't know that the investigators are breaking their neck, and I don't know why. I mean, I'm not understanding why, if you will. This was one of those situations where it was a white citizen. And, in fact, in the last couple of days, we've had a similar situation, which trying to keep a lid on, as it pertains to what could have been a home invasion and the death of an individual in somewhat the same area. But I really can't go any further than that at this time, Mr. Allen.
Okay. Well, I appreciate what you could inform us with, because I was very interested in that. And a lot of our listeners, we have tons of people in the queue right now. Mr. Edwards listening. I'd just like to tell them, if you'd like to speak to us, the number is 347-426-3904. Just hang up out of the queue and call back, and you'll pop up on the studio screen. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And we look forward to your calls. Yeah, Mr. Edwards.
Mr. Allen, let me do this. In that we're on the law and order and et cetera. There's a very disturbing situation and circumstances inside of the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. It is very, very disturbing, and some aspects of it have to do with Pierre Collins and the defense that was really not provided for him. And it is, there are some real serious questions about ethical conduct, by the public defender's office working with the county attorney. And there are some emails that apparently, I'm puzzled by this, that apparently has the public defender's office patting themselves on the back for getting the confession, and I'm puzzled. You know, we thought that we had the very well-known community activist, the Reverend Harding Smith. We had asked him to join us over the last couple weeks. You had been in contact with him and vetting him, and he was unavailable and not be available. And then, if I remember correctly, last week at our production meeting, we were discussing the fact that he said he was going to call in on tonight's program. Is he currently on the line, and has there been any update, the Reverend Harding Smith? Are you still there, Mr. Allen? Well, there's been a click off. I don't know where my co-host is gone. I did hear a click. I'm assuming that we are...
I am back, Mr. Edwards. I just got bombarded in the chat room. I'm sorry, I'm kind of screening folks. But to answer your question, Mr. Harding Smith has, last one thing I heard, I got a call and a message that he was in the hospital having surgery. I've had no follow-up since then.
Well, that was last week. Last Wednesday, he was having surgery, and he said he figured that recuperation would take place, and he'd be with us today, tonight, but we haven't heard from him. Okay, all right.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is that there are some interesting whispering going on within the Judiciary Committee about how the Pierre Collins situation was handled, and at what point did the public defender and then by extension the county attorney and then by extension the presiding judge, Tanya Benchford, at what point did they know and when were they told that Pierre Collins had confessed back on, what was it, the 8th of May Pastor Harding Smith that Pierre Collins, had killed his son. You know, we asked a series of questions, and by the way, we always are prepared to stand the test of review and scrutiny. Our programs, Wednesday before last and the prior Wednesday to that, can be recaptured. As I understand, Mr. Allen, we still have that feature in our relationship with Blog Radio New York City. Is that correct?
Yes, we're good. We're good all day.
So we had raised some questions about how the information was handled when on May 8, 2015, that Pierre Collins allegedly confessed to his spiritual advisor that he had been involved in the murder of his son, and I guess laid out all of the circumstances, including time, manner of disposing of the body, and et cetera. See, none of that came out of court, as I understand it. Yeah, none of that came out of court.
But I do still have that recording queued up. I mean, if you want our listeners, you know, I have some people saying, well, we didn't hear that. We didn't hear that, sending me messages via
We set these traps all the time. Let's play that. You say you have it queued up. Let's play that.
I have it queued up.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, this is Harlan Smith talking about Pierre Kylan's confession.
Link, since they started that out that way, that a pastor stealing money, you know, it just mushroomed into something else and went in all kinds of dark corners. Well, it started out with a lie.
Okay,
you know?
And you said you went to WCCO this morning and talked to the folks, the producers?
I talked to the producer, and they said they would remove it. I just told them that, listen, no one in this community or any community can tell you they could pass a sniff $1 towards towards Bowie's funeral. Because I did not take money for Bowie's funeral. I did not manage money. My name was not on any account. I used my own money to help facilitate some of the things I did for this boy's funeral. Not one, not 25 cents, not a dime came through my hands. I totally disassociated myself from anything that had to do with money. So they went and posted that Pastor Harding Smith is the same pastor that was accused of mismanaging funds for Bowie's funeral. How can I mismanage funds when I never managed funds in the first place? And these are the kind of slander of a pastor. These are kind of the hatred towards people of God that we are talking about, especially black pastors. We have it hard, and it's rough.
Okay, and so, I mean, out of the meeting with the producers, what were they willing to do?
They told me they are going to remove the part that said that you were involved with money or you mismanaged money. But the damage is already done. The damage has already been done when the seed is planted in the mind of people that this is a crooked pastor, that this is a pastor that was somehow involved in diverting funds from a dead child funeral. This is crazy.
Yeah.
This is the worst accusation you can make against anyone.
Okay, let me ask you this. Now, yesterday you had a press conference and a couple of stations were there to cover it. Now, it's rumored that Pierre Kylan did not act alone. Is that correct?
Right, this thing, what I said yesterday was the confession that Pierre Kylan gave in court is a different confession that he gave back in May. And just to let the community know, when Pierre Kylan did make that confession, it was not a confession that was sat on. Right there were immediate steps that were taken, which Mr. Collins agreed with, and several law enforcement agencies was contacted and brought in. So did he act alone? You see, Pierre told me so many different stories. It's hard sometimes to separate fact from fiction. Mr. Collins told me he did not do this alone. And I trust the prosecutor. They believe they have that man, and for this hearing to start in the community, we have to start somewhere. It has to be now. So from his own mouth, he stated in court that he acted alone. So I guess that's what we have to go with. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay.
And you have a good day. All right?
Okay. And we'll talk Wednesday.
Okay. And that was the interview with Harding Smith. Go ahead,
Mr. Allen. Let's make sure that we do this because I have just, before that tape was played, have indicated that there are some troubling rumors now going about with regards to the role of the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office not providing adequate counsel. In fact, it's called ineffective counsel. Could you give our listening audience the date of that interview, and which was the same date was played on this program? Could you give us the date so that people can make the necessary correspondence? Because Reverend Smith stayed away from going into any specific detail that Barway told him, he said Barway confessed, but he never said that Barway told him the manner in which he had taken the life of his son. Remember, we talked about that after after that had recording had been played. I now renew the inquiry. When did everybody know after the so-called confession on the 8th day of May 2015? And if so, why was there a restriction put on Pierre Collins on the day of his quote-unquote plea and immediate sentencing to 40 years without, well, 40 years in the state penitentiary?
Wow. Yeah, that.
But I'm glad we have that we have the tape and that you had interviewed Pastor Harding, and that was the first time that he indicated he would not be able to join us for a more in-depth venting of all of the circumstances. But I said on that same program after that tape that I was fascinated to know what was the setting inside of the Hennepin County Jail. Were they in a private room was where no recording was being made? Because if they were doing it in the traditional manner of sitting on the other side of the glass talking through the telephone, all of that conversation was recorded by the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department. So I thought that, and I continue to think that that was a very, very fair question. At what point did all these folks know? And now when I hear that Bender's office was patting itself on the back for helping to coordinate a situation in which there would be no significant testimony and would continue to provide liability protection to the municipality of Crystal and to the Crystal Police Department, because, you know, we haven't even gotten close to dealing with what happened with the Amber Alert or the absence of it, and what happened when Pierre Collins showed up with some Muslim clerics, if you will, or imams, as they are called, and things began to get real tough for him. But I'm so glad for those that have questioned you, according to what you just said, about the authenticity of the interview with the Reverend Harding Smith, that, yes, we have the capabilities of retaining all of our programs.
Yeah,
all lines are open.
Yes, and we do have a caller. Caller, you are live. They hung up just that quick. But we have another caller. Caller, welcome back to the show, Brother James. Any comments, concerns, topics? Go right ahead, sir.
You know, Don and Ron, it's been a little while since I spoke to you two good gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Good to hear your voice again. Good to have you back on the air. What's your observation and question?
It seems to me that the black community, the usual suspects, they got this love sensation where they love to hear you all's voices. They love to see what's going on. It's like you all got this sensational love song that they like to hear every Wednesday. But nobody really wants to get down and do the real good work of getting the black community together, getting the kids together, getting the job situation together, getting the school situation together. We got the biggest disparity gap in the nation. And every time you, just like you just said, Mr. Allen, that every time you see someone in power, such as Mr. Ellis, why do they drop their head? They act like little kids. But when their Caucasian colleagues call on them, and it's got really little nothing to do about the black community, they're in straight attention like they're an army.
Good point.
Yeah. Now, on Mr. Collins' situation, man, I thought it was awful strange that after that brother left court, I believe he had some child support issues.
Yes, sir.
That he's Caucasian.
Yes, he
because some people don't know, out of town people don't know that he has two kids by a Caucasian woman. And he got one kid that he brought over here from Liberia. And the Caucasian woman took him to court the very same morning that I guess they found out that he is the suspect And not only was he the suspect, but I think they had reason to believe from the phone pings, and you know that we got some folks
well,
here.
Well, let me just correct that just a tad, brother James. So particularly for our domestic and international audience, on the occasion in which the prosecutor made a lot of hay out of that per se, though you never had any testimony, if you will, because there was never a trial. On the morning in question, Mr. Collins had been summoned to court, and you're absolutely right, because actually there are, let me get it right, seven children involved, because he has two children by the woman that he was married to at the time of the so-called tragedy. He had Barway, his son, who came over here from Liberia in 2011. He then had two children he fathered with a Caucasian woman, and then she had two children by a previous relationship. Now, on that particular morning in question, where later on that afternoon, Barway Collins, returning from school, disappeared, the issue was child support for the four children in her custody, the Caucasian woman's custody, her two by some other individual, and the two that she maintained that she had by Pierre Collins. He came back. He began to try to do some checking. Contrary to what people said, Pierre Collins had been working. He had been working a job and et cetera, but there were some other issues that had come up about him being involved possibly in an arson fire and all that. But it really increased. The tension and the suspicion increased when 3 days after he reported his son missing, he and a small group of Islamic imams or Muslim clerics went to the Crystal police station to ask why there had not been an Amber Alert. The FBI was being called in, so that kind of tells you a little bit, you know what I'm saying? And suddenly, within 36 hours of him leaving very upset, he was told that he was a person of interest. They seized his car, they seized half of his clothing, they seized other garments and et cetera. Then he was asked to take a lie detector test. He did, and in the lie detector session, the only questions he kept being asked was, who was Uncle? Remember Uncle?
Yep.
Because that goes back to Harding Smith's reflections with us that Mr. Allen just got through playing. It also went back to, at one point, that the authorities in, let's say, the first 10 days of the disappearance of Barway were saying that there were other blacks who were involved. And I was at the press conference when a black undercover agent first accused Pierre Collins of murdering his son for the insurance. Iris Perez of KMFT had been told that by a law enforcement officer, but even she was surprised that morning as we stood in the parking lot of the complex when this brother, in fact, I initially thought that he was one of our community leaders, K.G. Wilson, because the brother was dressed, Brother James, in fatigues, in commando fatigues. He later walked to a car that was parked 100 yards away from the gathering. And by the way, I have the license number because I walked down and took the license number down. He went down, got in the car with another undercover officer, and later on my good friend Harding Smith went down. They talked. Harding Smith came back but never said anything or raised any questions about the allegation made by this unknown individual who's never been seen again. This black man, big brother too, about 6'4", about 290 fighting weight, if you will, made that allegation.
You know you killed that boy. You can see it written all over your face.
That's right. Now, the
and did you see the facial expression?
Yeah. Well, I knew it well because there are pictures that of all people that were standing right next to him when he went off was this commentator. Because I looked at him. I was like, wow, God dang, who is this cat? I made inquiry into the Liberian community for the next couple of days about who this gentleman was. In fact, there were individuals who knew who he was, and they knew the apartment that he had been put up at. Over there by Applebee's. okay? And I said, well, wow. I said, well, have you, you know, have y'all approached him and demanded that, that he step forward? How did he know about the insurance and et cetera? Then everything got quiet. But by that time, the locomotive was on the move because the Crystal Police, the FBI, and others had turned all of their attention to Pierre Collins. But all of a sudden, there was no importance relevant to who Uncle was. So I just wanted to make sure that we have absolute clarification and transparency with how it happened. Then we get down to what everyone expected was going to be a big trial in January, and allegedly on May 8th, 2015, Pierre Collins in a in a interrogation room at the county jail confessed to his religious or spiritual advisor that he, Pierre Collins, had killed his son, Marway Collins, taking him from one site to another site, and some way or another was able to lift him up and dump him into this big container. And so I would have liked to have heard that testimony, you know what I mean? Because, you know, the question we had to be asked was, Marway still alive? But then you remember in the paper, and on the day that he did his allocution, if you will, Barway, Pierre said that when he punched Barway that he actually killed him. Don't you remember that? It's in the newspaper. It's in the Star Tribune. And I was puzzled by that because that had to be a tremendous blow because actually Barway was taller than his dad. He was not as stocky and, of course, would not be as strong, but he was taller than his dad. Body weight would have been a tremendous burden given where Pierre would have had to have dragged him from the car because he could not have brought the car any closer to the edge of the river. So he would have had to have dragged this dead weight. Mr. Allen and I, a couple months ago, examined aerial shots on that particular, what would have been that particular day of the container that allegedly the deceased youngster was thrown into. You would have to actually, Brother James, have gone into the water, lifted this youngster up about 7 feet, and then somewhere or another lifted your own self up and pushed his body down into the container. I mean, that's what the county attorney was telling everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's nuts. That's nuts.
Yeah.
So,
But I'd like to say this,
Brother James.
After he left that court, after he left child support court,
mm-hmm.
Something was either something kind of made his mind snap or twist. Maybe it was the back money or money that he knew that he didn't really have readily available and he couldn't come up with. And I would just like to say that did he make a conscious decision at that point that he was going to sacrifice his son to do that for the insurance money just to pay the other ones off?
You know, Brother James, that's a good question. I don't know. We'll never know. But here's what you also have to keep in mind. Pierre Collins had more insurance policy on him than he did on Barway. So if he snapped, the proper way to have snapped was just to have blown his own brains out and taken that over $100,000 that he had on himself, as well as he had some money on some of the other children. But, see, we'll never know because the way that the public defender and the prosecutor and the court put this together, there he forfeited his right of appeal. Unless there are extraordinary circumstances in which the state Supreme Court will entertain to listen to, you will never hear from Pierre Collins again.
Wow.
I think that when that brother left that courtroom, from child support, he made a conscious decision that he was going to make it happen, but he was going to make it happen that way. Now, when that big brother pointed out that you could see it written all over your face, you know you did that. If you looked, when the camera got pushed on Mr. Collins, you could look at his face and tell. He looked it like a little kid that just got caught stealing candy out of a candy jar.
Okay, but Brother James, let me ask you this question. I have to do this in all fairness and transparency. Because the videos and et cetera, which all of a sudden did not show our Barway, the son, in the presence of the father, okay, the blow that was struck, here's what you got what you got caught into. The blow that Pierre said that he struck Marway with had to happen in an open park with over 100 apartments facing that park. Now, the question has never been answered. You can check for yourself. Where did he knock Marway unconscious at? If he did it in the apartment, James, then the current wife was an accessory before and after the murder of her stepson. Because somebody asked that same question a couple programs ago, right, Mr. Allen?
Mm-hmm.
And that question was put back to them. So think about it yourself, James. When he struck his son at around 3:20 p.m. Central Standard Time, where was that blow delivered? Where were they standing? And again, where was Uncle? Because in the video on the bus that was bringing him home, the
there's my dad
bus,
and there's my uncle.
That's right. So what happened
and
to Uncle?
This deal, he never made it inside the vestibule. He never stepped into the vestibule. There was a heavyset Liberian sister that came out. She was wrapped up in her nice garb. And somebody got that boy's attention, and he went to the left. He didn't go to the right. He went to the left. And that means that the kid either got the uncle got his attention and told him to come to the parking lot, or it was the father and the uncle waiting. But he knew one thing on that bus, that uncle and daddy was there in the parking lot.
Well, then the video cameras, because, see, I have been on the site a number of times, have counted all the video cameras. I'm talking about back in April. One of those video cameras should have caught the actual altercation. Now, what the Star Tribune originally wrote when they were really putting the final pieces together after the arrest of Pierre Collins was that he and his son were seen driving down 81 towards the Cub supermarket, where Pierre Collins and the ATM machine film showed that, came in to check on his account. That was around 3:45 p.m. Central Standard Time. Now, that also means that upon striking his son, wrapping him in the duct tape, and by the way, think about this, Brother James. If he, and he did have him in his possession or custody, if you will, according to what the county attorney then said, where was Pierre, and more importantly, where was Farway when they pulled into the parking lot? Because I just can't imagine that he had this duct tape child in the front or back seat, so he must have been in the trunk. Okay,
he had to be in the
trunk.
Bear
with me. Yeah, he had to be in the trunk. Now, we go to the site of where the child's body is dumped. Brother James, you need to go out there, you and any others, and take a look at the site and the distance between where you would, even though it was March, where you would have had to have drugged the body, you would have had to gone into the water. You would have had to go into the water with the body, push the body up at least 7 feet, and drop that body in the container that we've all seen by the aerial shot. I'm just saying that it would have been so important if the court would have required Pierre Collins to talk in terms of time, location, circumstances, and definitive proof that he knew that his son was dead or his son was not dead when he put him in the river.
Well,
if that
one thing you do know,
something would have been important.
If you look at that water, the depth of that water in that march, he had to have help. He had to have two people to help him carry that.
Yeah, well, you see, some way or another, and maybe the big brother who was a police undercover agent, maybe he knew what the answer to that was. I do know that the county attorney, public defender, and I think our good friend Pastor Harding Smith know the answer to that. But Harding Smith, you heard him on this program. Mr. Allen interviewed Harding Smith that evening, and Harding Smith, he did a qualifier. He said, well, you know, Pierre told so many different stories, I don't know which was what, how much was fantasy and et cetera. Okay, and that's what he kind of said at the press conference. But the fact of the matter is, the public defender should have demanded for the purpose of protecting the what constitutional rights Pierre Collins should have had, that he be protected in case there was a opportunity for appeal. See, there's no opportunity for this case ever to be appealed. And it's really, I mean, it's not funny, but it was a very clever move. Very clever move. A lot of sequences have not been explained. And I think it's so tragic because that child, that 10-year-old child, needed to, quote-unquote, be absolutely served by the appropriate inquiry in pursuit of justice. And I just think, my brothers, I don't think that that's happened. I don't think it's going to happen. And Brother James, you raised an interesting question. Who was Uncle?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like Uncle got away with accessory to murder.
Clearly did. But the judge, Tanya Fansford, never asked specific clarification or specificity when she had Pierre Collins stand up and say, do you agree with those things that are being stated here by the prosecution? And the public defender, who was supposed to be there to protect his rights, he being Mr. Collins, in pursuit of justice, didn't say a word.
Well, Mr. Edwards, you know all too well that the public pretender's office goes hand in hand with the state. They work hand in hand. The public pretender's office love to make you, let's make a deal. You can have a case tomorrow in the state of Minnesota. The public pretender's office can sit on the case, don't do anything up until it's the day for you, or the week or 2 days before you get ready to go to court. And before it's time for you to go to court, they don't have no facts. They haven't done any investigations. They'll tell you, we got an investigator.
Absolutely. You're right. Let me also say this, James, Brother James, and my associate, Miss Allen. I found it interesting that when Reverend Harding Smith had that press conference that Mr. Allen quizzed him on, that he indicated that after the confession on May 8th, that he visited Mr. Pierre Collins at least another 40 times. Is that your recollection, Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Because he is quoted as saying that he visited with Pierre Collins over 60 times. Well, at least 40 of those times, based on the date of May 8th, they had to be talking about the confession. Gentlemen, would you not agree?
I would agree with that 100%.
The responsibility of the minister to tell the attorney, because he was not Pierre Collins' attorney of record, the public defender was, at what point did, and we were going to ask him those questions here on this program, at what point did Pastor Harding Smith seek legal counsel to make sure that everybody's rights were being protected? No one can answer that now, and you can rest assured that Mike Freeman will make sure that this matter is not reviewed. So there it is, gentlemen. It looks like that the pursuit of justice did not happen in a clear-cut manner and a transparent manner that we were all, you know, being led to believe on the occasion of the guilty plea by Pierre Collins. And so the question then becomes, has justice really been served? I don't know.
It seemed like Pastor Harding was just trying to absolve himself from all the monies that he may have received, you know, in the backroom deals.
Oops. Mm-hmm. I hope not. I mean, I hope that, as he said, that he was not a minister of theft. And he said to my colleague, Mr. Allen, in the tape that we have as a part of our collection, of our archives, he said he had met with the producers at WCCO, and he got them to change a piece that they had ran a couple days before, in which there were allegations that there had been a misappropriation of money given in good faith by hundreds of people in the name of this child.
But the Liberian community said Pastor Harding took a lot of money.
Yeah, I know they did. I know.
And if you notice the day that brother with the fatigues bust out Mr. Collins, Pastor Harding pretty much took a back seat there, and then he brought in our good friend VJ. I said, "Now I know he ain't going to go for this okie doke."
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I said, I have the license number of the car in which three individuals were talking after the very large black gentleman with the fatigues on went back to that car, sat down on the passenger side. Later, Pastor Harding walked that 100 yards, talked to them for a period of time, came back. There were still emotions and things were running high. But you're right. The good minister did not take any position of defense. Of course, the very large, fatigue-clad brother never came back, never been seen again.
See, this is what I mean when I say we need to have very good people such as yourself and Mr. Allen, along with a few other good ones, that when situations come up like this here, the minister stay at the church on Sunday. If you're going to do anything, deal with it at church on Sunday. Don't bring it into the street as an investigator, because you're wearing too many hats, too many jackets, too many investigative badges, too many police badges. We don't know who you are, what you are, and where you're coming from.
Yes, yes. Doggone good point. Very good point. Yes. Yes.
That's the problem that we have here in Minnesota. The ministers want to be politicians. They want to be political leaders. They want to be community activists. They want to be this. They want to be that. But when it's a time to really stand up on something, they got big mouths and very little hearts.
Yeah. Thank you, Brother James. Appreciate you getting back with us. We hope to be hearing from you again. All right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we have another call.
Well, Brother Allen, looks like we're getting ready to wrap it up. I guess we have another call.
Yes, yes, yes. Someone's been on hold.
We want to get all the calls we can in. You know, we got about 3 minutes.
Yep, caller, you're live on the air. Okay, that's someone in the queue. Okay, that's not, unless they text me back if they want to talk, I'm just going to leave them in the queue. But, yeah, Mr. Edwards, this has been an interesting show, very interesting. A lot of good points came out, and I hope a lot of people listen and share the podcast with their community and their friends, because you're not going to get news like this in depth. In detail from any other place, period.
That's
not
right.
On a Sunday
that's
afternoon
right.
Or Monday
right.
through Friday.
Through Friday and other times. So, let me just say this, Mr. Allen, because you're not a sports fan. And as we said, we are reporting from the Target Center. The Minnesota Lynx, who had the best record at 18-6 in the WNBA, were defeated by over 20 points on their home. Let me make a prediction for you, and we'll have some additional stuff on our good friends at the Star Tribune. I think that there are some internal problems inside of the Minnesota Lynx as we speak, and that was the reason for the captain's meeting yesterday. It is quite clear to me as I watch most of the game tonight that it has not been cleared up, and owner Glenn Taylor may have to step in. I'll just pull your coat to that, my brother. There are problems inside of the Minnesota Lynx.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's so unfortunate to hear that.
Yeah, it has to do with race. Uh-oh.
Same old.
Yes. let James Brown, we appreciate our audience and the sector. We'll be back next week, and we'll talk a little bit about the University of Minnesota and possibly a big story about the actions of one of our civil rights organizations. Jane Brown, take us home.
Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve. Yeah.